everyone. Welcome to Popcorn Optional, a weekly movies podcast where we talk all things movies. Tonight we are tackling the big one. 72 episodes in, and it is time to finally talk about all 8 films of the Harry Potter franchise. We've been kind of waiting for a good excuse to do this, and with Fantastic Beasts coming out in 2 weeks, it's finally time.
And Bohemian Rhapsody coming out this
week. Yes, Queen was a big influence on Christopher Columbus. Primarily yes. The first 2 Harry Potter films. So, and Rami Malek also wanted to play Voldemort. So there is that.
the teeth really help sell it. You know?
Yeah, Snake teeth. Voldemort. You know.
Did you guys know that Chris Columbus's production company is called 1492 Pictures?
Uh huh.
Yeah. It's so good. That's so good.
The year that he sailed the ocean blue.
And then caused the deaths of millions of people. But
but we get the day from work, so who's
and
the real winners?
I live on Columbus Avenue, you guys, so I am complicit.
Oh.
You're all in on Christopher.
Trevor, although name the 3 boats really quick.
Oh, it's the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria. Come on.
Okay, cool.
I went to white suburban elementary school. Okay. Who are we kidding?
Okay. That's fine. I'm just being safe. My name is Cameron Salina. I'm joined by my co-host Jake Brown and Trevor Allison, as you may have guessed. And we're reviewing all 8 Harry Potter films in one. Hopefully we don't spend an hour on each episode. I have a feeling that would bore listeners, as well as we may kill each other by the end of this. Because as of recording, that'd be at 4 a.m. when we finish. And that'd be bad. But
let's be real. That's the only thing keeping us from spending an hour on each one of them.
Yes.
Yes.
That's we could very easily break down everything of these films into the morning and have plenty to talk about because they're that good. We actually all went to go see these movies in college, I think, if I remember right. Like, I think at least the last 2. I don't know when. I can't remember when Half-Blood Prince came out. But we weren't in college yet, actually. That came out the summer in between. The last 2 films, at least, we all went to go see together, if I remember right, which is weird to think about that happening, 8 years ago.
Oh, wow.
Almost 8 years ago to the day. Okay.
Man, I feel so old.
Yeah, wait.
I will say, though.
Wait till you have a kid.
I'm just gonna say right now, we're gonna spoil all of these movies.
Oh, yeah.
Like the moment we start talking about them, and I'm gonna spoil Deathly Hallows Part 1 right now, because I will never forget a girl that was dressed up as Dobby was carried out dead like a fallen soldier in a Roman gladiator battlefield above everybody's heads. And she just laid limp in her pillowcase and ears and everything. And yeah, that was amazing.
Yeah, I mean, so let's quickly talk kind of background with this, because I could be wrong, but we all grew up reading these books. Like, when did you guys come in? I think I came in, like, Prisoner of Azkaban had just been released, and then I started reading the books. Like, I read 1, 2, 3, and then from there was on the wait cycle, I guess you could call
it. Well, Cameron, here's the thing. Harry Potter's of the devil, and...
so that's where Jake was with this. Okay.
I actually... I grew up reading these books. I started reading them when I was like 10, I think. I read Sorcerer's Stone and was like, this is the best thing ever. And I believe I had read Chamber of Secrets as well. Maybe Azkaban before the first movie came out. And the movie came out on my birthday, my 11th birthday, guys. It was like my letter to Hogwarts was the Harry Potter movie.
Nice.
And... yeah, that was a pretty awesome birthday party.
Nice.
Harry Potter was a huge part of my childhood. I've read all of them multiple times, and like I was the kid waiting in line for it to come out that night, and when I would get it, I would read the entire thing in one setting and then pass out and then like read it again the next day.
You were that kid?
Yeah.
Are you a fast reader?
I am a pretty fast reader, and I owe a lot of that to Harry Potter. Like I would just consume those things. So I was a huge Harry Potter fan, still love the books and the series and the movies as well. We'll get into that more obviously, but yeah, I mean, Harry Potter was a big part of my childhood growing up.
So I took kind of a meandering path to Harry Potter. I first quote unquote read the Sorcerer's Stone by having my fourth grade teacher read it to our class in that like 10 minutes after recess every day, you know, where you just kind of chill and your teacher reads a book to you. So that was my intro to it. And I think that Azkaban had either just come out or was coming out. I quickly read the next two, really liked them. Read Goblet of Fire, borrowed a friend's copy. I think they read it the day after it came out and I read it the next day. And then I went on Harry Potter hiatus for like 9 years. By the time Order of Phoenix came around, book form, I was in my like too cool for school teenager phase and was like, oh, I don't need that anymore. So I kind of knew it was around, didn't really care about it, whatever, had kind of the magic had been lost, pun intended. And then I Half-Blood Prince, the movie is coming out in 2009. And I have a bunch of friends in Indiana. They're like, hey, we're going to go see it at midnight. Do you want to come? And I'm like, well, yeah, sure. Okay. I read the first four books. I've seen the first movie. So I tried to hurry up and watch all the movies. I didn't have time to watch it. So fun fact, I saw the Half-Blood Prince movie before I saw the Order of the Phoenix movie.
Interesting.
And I had not read either of the books, but I did. Once I realized I was doing all the movie thing really quick, I jumped on SparkNotes, read the chapter by chapter summary of the last three books. And then I watched.
Oh, what a way to read the Deathly Hallows.
And then I watched. It was pretty bizarre. And then I watched, you know, Half-Blood Prince at midnight. And then I was at, you know, as we just talked about, Deathly Hallows parts 1 and 2 at midnight. And then just last year, I bought the box set and read them all 1 to 7 about a year ago.
Wow. Nice.
So very that nice. Was the first time. Last year was the first time I had read books 5, 6, and 7. And
those are the
they're
best
great.
Books.
I mean, yeah. So like I said, I had kind of a meandering path to it, but it also gives me this weird. I have some chronological issues sometimes when I think of this in my head of the order that things happen. Especially books 5, 6. But yeah, I mean, I love Harry Potter. It's fantastic. Part of the reason I bought the box set was like, oh, I'm having a kid. I have to have these books for my kid. I mean, I know she won't be able to read for like 7 or 8 years. Those books anyway. But right.
Ambitious.
But maybe. But yeah, I mean, I kind of wish I had stuck with it a little bit more to have kind of a more natural intro point, but still great. One of the great series. I think that since this series happened, so many books and movies have been trying to copy both of them and none of them have equaled
it. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I grew up with these books. I went to go see every movie on opening weekend. I mean, I remember going to see the first one on opening weekend. I remember I have so many memories with these, and I think one of the, once again, magical things about these is that at least for our generation, like, I got to grow up with these characters to the point where it's like, as pathetic as this is going to sound, they felt like friends of ours.
Oh, I mean, Cameron, like, you and I, we were the same age as them as the books were coming out.
Yeah.
Like, I remember,
yeah,
like, being like, wow, I could do that. I'm 11.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And so that's amazing. I've had some of my favorite movie going experiences going to see these. I've only ever actually, I think, read the books once. I've listened to them on audiobook a couple times though. With a job that makes you drive a lot, it's very convenient to do so. But what's funny is, Jake, that night that you mentioned about Dobby being carried out also has one of my favorite nights in a movie ever, because spoiler, at the end of Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 1, Dobby dies, and I think the girls behind us went through box of tissues.
They were
in that
sobbing.
Like 5 minutes.
It was so weeping. Loud. It was incredibly loud.
You could hear boogers, like them sniffling boogers back up and then blowing them. I mean, to the point where it's like that scene is almost ruined for me.
I actually thought that like something was wrong. Like, did someone get a text that like their mom died in a car accident or something? Because
yeah.
Like it was It was like next
not a
level.
Proportional
it was,
response.
It was too much.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. It's pretty funny though that's I think that just goes to show like how invested people are in this series. And that's something that J.K. Rowling has just weaved into it. I mean, there's so much going on with these books outside of these books. There's people playing Quidditch. There's Harry Potter conventions. Like, I don't think that there's ever, like, the last time there was something this big was Star Wars. Like, this is a once in a generation type thing that I think a lot of people take for granted. And so, you know, it's fitting that now we get to go through this together, all 8 films at once. Let's talk a little bit. Well, let's kind of get into our overall thoughts of it. Okay, let me say this. Give me a quick one-liner on your overall thoughts of this. Let's go, Jake.
Okay. One sentence. That's what I'll say. This honestly could be argued as the best film franchise ever, because it is definitely the most commercially successful. But just the fact that it's just so consistently well done over the span of 8 movies with children actors that were casted at that age is a miracle. These movies are overall a very entertaining and magical time. And yeah, I think that's, for me, that's the thing, is just like the fact that they are all so consistently good is incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's an astounding achievement of art and cinema. With the cohesion that they have, despite a lot of different directors working on them. But I think the biggest thing that I can think of is what a great job David Heyman and Steve Kloves did. David Heyman's the producer, kind of the mastermind of this whole thing. Steve Kloves wrote almost all of the screenplays. It almost shouldn't have been this good. Like, there's no way that anyone could have expected it to been this good. 8 movies in 10 mm-hmm. years. Like Jake said, child actors. It's independent of it being great stories and great characters. Putting out this many great movies with such cohesion is really impressive.
Yeah, I don't think I could have said it better than either of you guys said it, so I'm not going to try to. But yeah, I think it's pretty apparent that we all love this series. And so if you are somebody who dislikes Harry Potter or just doesn't understand the hype behind it, this podcast that's about to happen probably isn't for you. And I would recommend going to listen to one of our other episodes, because we're about to nerd out on all 8 Harry Potter films. So let's go ahead and get into reviewing these movies. And the way that I've kind of broken this down is that at least for me, the first 2 movies kind of fall into one cohesive category. To me, it's like part 1 and 2 of the Christopher Columbus Harry Potter films. They feel so separate from the rest of the series that it's almost hard to review them as separate things because of, I mean, the look, the feel of them, the tone, everything about them is different. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, you know, in retrospect, looking back at these 2 movies, because I remember at the time as a kid how magical these films were. Once again, that phrase is going to get used over and over again tonight, because there's no other way
pun
to describe
it. Pun is intended
them.
Every time.
But
every time.
Yes, every single time. But I remember at the time thinking how magical and perfect these movies were as a kid. And then when the 3rd one came out, it was like, wait, hold on a sec. That's how they should feel. That's so, like, that's how I envisioned it. So in retrospect, do you guys, like, where do these films stand for you guys?
Yeah, I don't think I saw them till a couple years later. And then I've also seen, you know, 15 minute chunks on ABC Family once a month for the past 15 years of just these 2 films. Apparently that's all ABC Family ever got the rights to air. That's what Freeform is now for you young kids. We called ABC.
Except they don't have the rights anymore.
Yeah, they have a different feel. And that's because you hired Chris Columbus, who makes really good kids movies and makes Home Alone, which mm-hmm. is a fantastic movie. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it was quite the right feel for this series. And we'll talk too much about Alfonso Cuarón in a few minutes. But I don't think Chris Columbus did a bad job. I don't think, and I think it sort of works that you're kind of eased into the series. It's a little bit frustrating looking back and thinking about how they could have been better, I think. But in no way are these movies subpar or bad. The acting is a little bit iffy with the kids in a couple places, but they weren't very experienced. They were very young, and they definitely grow in that aspect. Looking back, I used to be very negative about these movies, but thinking about it a little now, I think they're very good. My frustration just comes from that they could have been better.
Yeah. I
think they could have been way better.
I totally agree with you, Trevor. Like, these are Christopher Columbus films, and they are just like every other Christopher Columbus film. They're fine. You know, like, that's... I think he's like one of those directors where, yes, Home Alone is fantastic, but everything else he does has just been like, yeah, it's fine. It's Christopher Columbus. Like, it's good. It's
like,
not bad.
Pixels is great, but everything else is kind of meh.
Exactly.
Like, you team up with Adam Sandler, you're going to get a knockout. That's pretty guaranteed.
Exactly. But you know what you're getting with him. Like, he's a consistent guy. And it was actually between like him and Spielberg to direct these first two films. Yeah. And Spielberg was a little hesitant on it. And Columbus decided...
Spielberg wanted to make them
that
animated.
Was his, that, wow. Yeah. He also said, did you guys see the quote from him that he said that making these movies would basically just be like withdrawing money from the bank? And he said there's no challenge involved in that.
He said it would be too easy. And they decided to go with Christopher Columbus because, I mean, Steven Spielberg was kind of on the fence, but also because of Christopher Columbus's experience with children on Home Alone. And, I mean, he obviously killed it. They do their job, but I think what these things do incredibly well that they don't get enough credit for is the world building that Christopher Columbus does for the entire rest of the series. I mean, if you look at the entire rest of the series, everything is kept the same in terms of cast, the score, the production design. Like, all of those things were established by Christopher Columbus and his team. Like, they built this world.
When John Williams writes his third best piece ever, you don't do anything else. Mm-hmm. You don't.
Yeah, and we'll talk more about that later. But I mean, it's the casting job done here with these kids, the world building that they did in all the different ways. Yes, they are a little bit more kiddish, but this is also more kiddish material to be working with. You're working with 11-year-olds.
Right. These two books are definitely more whimsical than the rest of the books.
Absolutely.
There's like a certain bit of like lightness.
It feels
to
like
this.
I know you guys referenced growing like the audience growing up with the books and growing up with the characters. It almost feels like the target audience changed with these films as well. Like the target audience, like this movie is made for 12-year-olds.
Yeah. And I think that's what's like so cool about this series is like the series is designed to grow with the audience. Like the way that J.K. Rowling wrote these and the way these movies are made are not intended for like, okay, 11-year-old, let's now watch all the Harry Potter movies. Like you could do that with Star Wars, you know, like whereas this is like, okay, you're 11. We're going to watch maybe like the first 3 Harry Potter movies. Then next year we might watch the 4th one. Then we might wait 2 years and watch the 5th one. Like,
I'm going to do that with my kids with the books. Yeah. They're going to get one book per year.
There you go.
Which even the rating from the MPAA, it's like the first 3 movies are all PG. And then the 4th one goes to PG-13. Like, they're definitely progressing in tone and subject matter. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
And okay, so let's even get into casting outside of the 3 leads. Like, casting 3 kids like this that for 10 years are able to play these roles and even grow up and be the perfect person, not as a kid, but as a teenager and as a adult in these roles is something that I don't think that they could have even anticipated how well it went. Like, how well they grow up, each of those kids grows up into the adult versions of these. And by adult, I mean like when they're 18 and, you know, put in the last film. But then even outside of that, you know, casting Tom Felton as Draco is a perfect, like, slimy
he's
little...
so good.
Like,
he's so good.
Just rat. casting Robbie Coltrane as Hagrid is just the perfect, like, huggable giant who could, like, destroy you if he really wanted to. Mm-hmm. And then outside of all of this, you cast one of the greatest thespians, Alan Rickman, as, we'll talk about it later, but as maybe one of the greatest characters ever written.
Yeah.
And it's like, I can't picture anybody else other than Alan Rickman having played this, especially when you get to the latter film.
The character wouldn't work the same way without Alan Rickman playing.
Mm-mm.
Yeah.
No.
I think also to casting, granted this is more like behind the scenes stuff and not so much the films themselves, but apparently a big part of like casting decisions was like how the actors would interact with the children actors on set. And so apparently there was just like a lot of awesome mentorship that was happening. And I think that shows on screen as well. Like not like the characters are looking up to these adults as their teachers, but like you can sense that bond in real life too, of like these kids and adults like respecting each other and learning from each other. And I don't know, man. Just I think this is probably one of the best casted series of all time.
We didn't even
like. I think it's one of the most underrated casting jobs.
Oh yeah, ever. We didn't talk about Maggie Smith yet, who is one of the greats of all time. Just has gotten better with age. She's it's worth watching Downton Abbey just for her, pretty much, because she's so great. we have to talk about Richard Harris. I feel like I'm about to do I'm going to do my Stephen A. Smith thing. You know that I am respectful of the dead. But
Thank you. Yeah.
The worst cast person is the one who happened to die in the middle of the series, which is a bizarre thing.
Right.
The problem is,
which you're made even more aware of when Michael Gambon comes in and
takes
over.
Here's the thing. Yeah, the problem is that Richard Harris was not did not have the physical presence that Dumbledore needed. And honestly, if what should have been done in this, with looking at with hindsight, is they should have cast someone who was like 45 or 50 and had them wear old person makeup. Richard Harris's son, Jared Harris, would have been a pretty good casting choice, I think. But I think they didn't get the feel, but they definitely fixed it when they had the opportunity to. So
right, there's a certain like kookiness to Dumbledore, at least in the books, how he's written, that he's kind of like, there's a certain like joyful child like nature to him, but then along like on the flip side, like at the flip of a hat, he could destroy you with like a flick of the wrist. I mean, and so it's like I never felt terrified by Richard Harris's character, nor did I ever feel like he was just some like grown up trying to be a kid.
He kind of had that,
like, there's multiple times in the book,
"Are you sure you aren't making this up, Grandpa?" kind of vibe to him.
Exactly. Okay, so let's go ahead and move on to the third movie, Prisoner of Azkaban, my personal favorite of the trilogy. I'll go ahead and show my cards a little bit early. We're going to talk about our rankings later on. I listed this in my top 10 films when we did our very first episode, and it going back and rewatching these this past week, it blows my mind that watching the first two films that we then get this film.
When you hire one of the greatest directors of all time, you get a good movie. That's just the way that it
imagine
works.
That. Yeah.
But like the fact that Cuarón would take this movie, like such an like artistic director going in to direct, like, can you imagine like watching this and then being like, yeah, you know, I kind of want to do, like, they must have had to have been like, look, we see your talent. You do whatever you want. Go ahead.
I was reading about that this week. He was really hesitant about it initially. And then he went and read the books and then he was like, this is awesome. I'm in. Let's do it. So, Alfonso Cuarón is a person too, just like the rest of us.
But except when he puts his pants on in the morning, he makes amazing movies.
Yeah, he was, you know, right off of
which
Y Tu Mamá También, which had a lot of buzz, especially among the kind of artsy crowd. He apparently was
and is a completely more adult movie than anything Harry Potter ever touches. I mean, that, and that's the thing, is like, he goes from that to this and then to Children of Men. It's just such a weird, like, not a bad thing at all, but it's just such a like weird, like, one-off in his career.
I mean, I could, I think I've said this before, I could make an argument that Children of Men is the best movie of the 21st century. And and to have some, like you're saying, it's just weird to have someone of that caliber in a series like that. But I mean,
and then he almost did Hunger Games.
Oh man, that would have been way, way better than what we got.
If only.
I think you see his impact on the rest of the series. I think that this is the movie that ramps everything up, and where it's like, all right, we can make this movie longer than 2 hours as long as it's good. We can tell the stories that need to be told. We can do this in a beautiful, imaginative way. We don't just have to make a movie for kids. We're just making a good movie about a good, like, with great source material.
This was the first in the series where there was some, I don't want to use the word like pretty major, but there was definitely some pruning of the source material. The first two were pretty much like book to script to screen. Obviously there were a few little adjustments, but they were very, very strict in their following what the books were. This definitely tells the same story, but there's definitely liberties taken that significantly help the film, I think. Obviously, I mean, we can rave all day about how great of a job Cuarón does with this and what it did for the series. But I think my favorite part about this installment is that it turns Harry Potter out of a more childlike blockbuster style film into a more like gothic fantasy type of film. We actually enter the world of witchcraft and wizardry, of a like traditional gothic style storytelling. I mean, I think like when you see the werewolf for the first time silhouetted on the moon and the music swells, that's like that just felt like classic gothic horror. And it was awesome. And we finally get to see the development of our characters. It's like, okay, they're 13. They're basically adults now, guys. that's what, I'm 13, Mom. I'm not a kid anymore. But we actually get some character development.
I think this is the first, and this goes along with what you're saying, Jake. I think this is the first time we get like the sets that we're going to have for the rest of the series, where Hogwarts really looks like it's going to, where it looks like a full place and not just a couple classrooms and a mess hall. Also, the Sirius Black storyline, which is basically the film in a lot of ways, it really builds out the whole world. And I think that Chris Columbus set us on this really good path of building out the world, but with the Sirius Black escaping from Azkaban, everyone talking about it, we get to truly see like the impact of this world and the depth to it. And I think this is really the gateway into what the rest of the series is going to become.
Yeah. And it's the one film that, you know, doesn't feature Voldemort whatsoever. It's, you know, like we said for Cuarón, where it's a one-off for his career, it's almost this like one-off for the series of like, okay, let's take a step back and get a little bit more personal with all of these characters so that moving forward, we understand all these, like, it's almost setting up the chessboard for the moves to come. With understanding Harry and his relationship to Sirius, or the dynamics between the three kids, or I mean, because you even get like the tension building between Harry and Snape, and there's all like in the chessboard of like who betrayed who and all the, I mean, it's, there's so many moving pieces, and you know, we already talked about what a great addition Michael Gambon was, but once again, what a great addition Gary Oldman was.
Oh yeah.
The one part that people are always kind of, they always talk about with this film is, this is the one film in the series that involves time travel. Was, do you guys think, because time travel is just such a tricky thing, and there are very few films that have actually done it right. I mean, there are probably enough films on that you can count them on one hand that have actually done time travel right. It's probably like Back to the Future movies, Looper, and this.
I think Star Trek does a good job with it.
But do you guys, like, The new series, the Kelvin series, the or series. The original?
Yeah. I think they do a good job with it.
Yeah.
But yeah, in this, it's a little bit weird that no one ever suggests doing anything like that ever again. It's also a little bit weird that there is...
That was my one question, was like, does this mess up things for the rest of the series?
There are no ramifications of this time travel. Which is fine. You can have, that's kind of the Star Trek theory that they went with, instead of the Back to the Future, theory of the...
Yeah, it's almost like a closed loop.
But I don't want to spoil anything. If you guys have or have not read Cursed Child, it does deal with time travel. So I think that plot hole questions from a meta series wise are kind of addressed with Cursed Child, which is probably going to be a movie in 10 years, right? Why would you not make it into a movie? That's $1 billion in the bank right there.
Yeah.
There are a few. I don't think there's any plot issues in this film from it, but it's weird that it's pretty conspicuously absent from the rest of the series.
Right. Like there's a. So you guys know Honest Trailers, right? Mm-hmm. There's a, or maybe it's How It Should Have Ended. I think it's How It Should Have Ended. Did a thing where it's like Snape in the 7th movie, and he's just twisting it back like 3,000 times. He's like, "I'm gonna save Lily. I'm gonna save Lily. I'm gonna save Lily." It's like, yeah, that actually makes quite a bit of sense. Okay.
Yeah, that it's one of those things where like when you start thinking about it, it does kind of mess with the entire series in a way, which is frustrating. But they do it in such a like self-contained story and self-contained way that you do kind of forget about it. It's one of those things where it's like after Azkaban, by the time you're in Goblet of Fire, you're just kind of like, now we're in the Triwizard
Tournament. Well, how are we going to survive this brush with...
Right.
Yeah. But then you start thinking back and you're like, oh yeah, they could have just done time travel the whole time.
But to me, at least the way I look at it is that what Hermione has, that time travel thing, and I haven't done research on this, for all we know that there is a very simple explanation, but to me it was always like, it's such a rare artifact that like not everybody has access to that. It's not something that like you can just like wave your wand and be like, travel back in time. It's more like it's a very special thing that it's like maybe it's like not anyone could get.
I think the easiest explanation is that there's only one of them. It belongs to Dumbledore and he only uses it when he knows that it's the right time.
Mm-hmm. They did do a good job of like establishing this is an incredibly like extreme case situation. No one else has one of these. They did do a good job of making it seem rare, but it is one of those things where it's like, well, what if Voldemort gets a hold of that? See, now you got a story.
Right. I think Voldemort's doing some pretty BA stuff though. But Voldemort leads us right into the next movie, Goblet of Fire, the 4th Harry Potter film. The Triwizard Tournament. The bringing together of 3 separate schools to duel it out to see who will be the Triwizard Tournament champion. But oops, Harry Potter ends up being the 4th champion for the first time ever. I feel like as a book, this is one of my favorite books. Just because there's so much going on and introduces so many new things. It introduces the idea of like, there's magic in other countries. Other countries have their own rules and schools and all these different things. And then, we get to the movie and the movie, they have to tone it down. They have to kind of condense everything. Do you guys think this movie as a whole does as good of a job capturing the scope of the world as the book does?
So I might be controversial in saying I think the Goblet of Fire is one of the lower films on my totem pole. I think there's too much going on.
I think this is like, the worst movie. Mm-hmm. I will say.
Whoa, the worst movie. I wouldn't say it's the worst.
You think it's the worst?
I love the story. I loved the book.
Oh wow,
love the book. It's probably my second favorite book. But I don't think that Mike Newell really got it. It just doesn't, mm-hmm. it doesn't feel right. Robert Pattinson is awful in this movie. And I don't, I'm not one of those Robert Pattinson is always awful people. I think that he's a fine actor. In a lot of situations,
dude, watch Good Times.
I know. He's I need to see that.
Good Times is nuts. Or Lost City of Z.
He mm-hmm. is not what Cedric Diggory is supposed to be. From a feel standpoint, from an aesthetic standpoint, I don't know that that's Mike Newell's fault specifically, but I do agree. There's a lot going on. It's not tied up very well.
I think that though that there's other things in this that are like this film. Gives you arguably the worst scene in the whole entire series, or at least the worst piece of acting, which definitely falls on Mike Newell as a director.
Yeah, that's the thing, is it's just like there's so much going on, and you're asking a lot of really young actors that aren't being guided well, I think, in certain situations.
Is this the one where where Daniel Radcliffe really needed a haircut? Is this the really bad one?
Yes. Yeah. He looks like a walking mop. Yeah. So also there's so much cool stuff that happens in Goblet of Fire in terms of like expanding the world outside of Hogwarts that they don't, like the Quidditch World Cup in the book is like one of the coolest parts and they don't show it. And I was so frustrated when they did that. I was like, oh my gosh, Quidditch is such a cool thing. And we're going to get to see the World Cup, the best Quidditch players ever. And now we're tilting up to the sky and now we're tilting down and they're back at camp. Are we seriously not going to get any of the Quidditch World Cup? Like that's right. What my experience was.
Not even a
was.
Montage? Can we get 30 seconds?
Yeah, exactly. But like the Triwizard Tournament stuff and like the lore and the world building of this is fantastic. But I just think that it's a transitioning point. It almost feels like a step backwards from Azkaban in a way of like it's in between the Columbus and the Azkaban films, and that there's a lot that hinges plot wise on this film for like the rest of the story and this book that it just, I don't think they did that pivot super, super well.
This is not a big deal in the Goblet of Fire, but the way that this movie handles the multiple love triangles is really awkward and hard to watch. And I don't mean it like in a good way. It's just all a little bit too much. The Harry Cho Cedric triangle, the Crumb Hermione Ron triangle with the poor Patel twins caught in the middle of everything. It's all just, it's like, I don't know, Chris Columbus should have directed this movie.
Right. But this is the first movie in the series. So like I've held this long thought that this series would work so much better as like an HBO six episode series. Where like every school year gets like
that's
six
going
episodes.
To happen in 20 years.
And this is the
probably.
One where it's, oh, I totally believe so. But it's like you get a big budget TV, like with how Game of Thrones is going nowadays and the Lord of the Rings series, everybody has their big budget TV series. Like if you actually gave them 6 hours for this, this could be the best season with how much they'd be able to dig into, like, because you cut out the whole Rita Skeeter thing. All of the events are so much shorter. Like Jake said, the Quidditch World Cup gets cut down and there's all this like weird stuff that happens after the Quidditch World Cup of like the Stan Shunpike, the driver, one of the attendant of the night bus, like is in the woods. And there's all this like introduction of the Death Eaters that kind of gets glossed over. There's so much world building that kind of just gets lost.
Yeah, it's too fast.
And I think that speaks to maybe my biggest criticism of the whole series. Something that it does not do that the book does is it does not humanize the Death Eaters very well. They're just shadowy, sketchy people and don't really have a reason for anything. Something I do love about this movie is David Tennant, who's amazing as Barty Crouch Jr., really nails the whole weird tongue thing. And I
which is something that he totally added in himself. Only David Tennant can do.
Why not?
Do you guys think that's telegraphed, though? I mean, the twist at the end of him, of Moody actually being a polyjuiced version of Barty Crouch Jr. Is that telegraphed to you in the movie? Because I don't remember that being telegraphed in the book.
Yeah, I don't feel like it was. But I mean, I knew it when I saw the movie, so it's hard to really gauge.
Yeah, I've gone into all of these movies like knowing the book and also what's happening like after this movie, you know? And so it's really hard to say if it's telegraphed or not.
So one thing I do want to commend this movie on, though, is that the first appearance of Voldemort, that scene in the graveyard, at least for me, was absolutely terrifying as a kid. Mm-hmm. Like, they nailed that scene in terms of, like, the look of Voldemort, the introduction of Ralph Fiennes' version of him. All of it's just terrifying. Like, you instantly, like, the world flips on its head at that point. Like, you get that, like, a cataclysmic shift has just happened.
Oh, yeah.
I completely agree.
Yeah.
And they, like, that part's nailed. Everything else is kind of mediocre.
Priori incantatum, where his wand explodes, and you see all the people that he's killed.
Oh.
Whole the emotion there is fantastic. That part is really well done. I agree.
Also, when he goes Chinese fireball, ooh,
ooh, that part's pretty great.
Yeah, I wonder if there's like uncut versions of these, or like how.
Yeah,
to the script is the end version.
Yeah, I wonder how much extra was shot and didn't make it into the final cut. That would be interesting.
Okay, so moving on past this to Order of the Phoenix, the fifth book, the first book in this new world. I mean, it really feels like, at least for me, it's like there's a split in the series, if you really want to put it that way, of like the first four movies are like pre-Voldemort, the other ones are like post-Voldemort. I mean, so it's like, there's these two different halves, and we get this new introduction into the world. And the first thing that we're kind of brought into is like, this idea that like the Ministry is seeing that Harry and Dumbledore are liars. And that's an interesting angle to play up this, like the government being against the truth, which is very timely for nowadays. We won't need to get into that.
How many, when you watch this movie, how many times do you want to punch the wall? It's like at least 10 for me.
Yeah. Every time Umbridge is on screen, I'm like,
so to talk, to kind of get what you were saying a second ago, Cam, you know, there really is kind of a divide, strong division between the first four films, the second four films. I think the Voldemort thing is there. I think that David Yates is the other big reason for this. And I think,
right.
Prisoner of Azkaban is my favorite film in the series, and I think it's the best, and I love Alfonso Cuarón, but David Yates was born to direct these movies. He nails the feel. Right. He knows how everything is supposed to go. He knows how it's supposed to look. And from here on, these things are really what I think of when I think of the Harry Potter series. And I think he's continued that with the Fantastic Beasts movies. And I love that he's just leaned into it and understands like this is his wheelhouse. Like, these are the films for him and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
So what a great decision to come in, because the director situation has been kind of weird in these films, but to get someone who's willing to stick with it, but also has the vision of what these films should be is really impressive.
Yeah. And he really hadn't done much before these either. That's the crazy thing. It's like, he just kind of came into, I'm going to do these Harry Potter movies, and they're gonna be awesome. He kills it, man. And I totally agree with you, Trevor, that like, he establishes what people think of as Harry Potter in terms of like the aesthetic, the most impactful moments in the story all happen under his guidance. Order of the Phoenix is my favorite overall of the series, both the book and the film.
Okay. Wow.
I think that this is where we see Harry grow the most as a character, and where the stakes are raised, and also where this is like, this is the most conflict, I think. This is the most character development that we have. It also is surprisingly, even though it's the longest book in the series besides Deathly Hallows, I think it's one of the shortest films. Like, they somehow made it really tight but it didn't feel overpacked the way that Goblet of Fire did. And also, we get an incredible villain in Umbridge. Like, Voldemort himself is a very hate, like, person that you hate, and, like, he's a very great, scary villain. But Umbridge is that, like, she's one of the best villains of the 20th century.
Oh.
Or 21st century.
Oh, yeah. And the performance by Imelda Staunton just completely sells it. It's, she's perfect.
It's incredible. It's incredible. But I think that this, like you said, guys, it just, like, it sets the tone, it sets the stakes, and we see a ton of growth from the characters and a totally new direction for the film, the series, and that's why it's my personal favorite.
I think what makes this, the film and the book, really great is, I think that J.K. Rowling did this on purpose, where, you know, before, we always know that Grandpa Santa Claus Jesus Dumbledore is there to fix whatever goes wrong. And this is the one where we're like, maybe he is sort of human and doesn't always know what's happening and isn't always there, which turns out to be wrong. He always does know what's happening and he is always there. But this is the film where, and like you said, where really we see the growth of the characters. And I think that Dumbledore's absence for a lot of it is a big reason why.
Do you think that rift between Harry and Dumbledore is as believable as in the book? Like, you really feel like this, like, loneliness of Harry in the book. And in the movie, there's certain angles that we don't get of why Harry is by himself so much or why he's so isolated. Is that an element that works for you guys, or is it kind of one that, like, in the... Oh, so even as I'm asking this, you guys brought up a good point in The Goblet of Fire, which is that as readers of the books, we have a certain bit of knowledge, you know, in the element of, like, Barty Crouch Jr. being Mad-Eye Moody. And so I'm always curious. Like, I'd always love to hear someone's opinion on these movies who's never read the book. I don't know if I've ever, like, had a conversation with somebody, but that'd be something that I'd be interested in exploring. I mean, I don't know if you guys have a thought on that or not, but that's something that we just kind of assume, and then we're like, oh, yeah, there's a rift between them because of Harry's isolated, because, like, in the book, all these things, but we don't have that here.
You know, Jake talked about how short it is. I think that if you're going to add 10 minutes, you spend your 10 minutes with that. Kind of what Ron and Hermione are doing, what's going on, why Harry is stuck feeling so alone. I know they didn't want to do it because they'd have to build another set, but I would have loved to see 5 minutes at St. Mungo's Hospital with Neville and his parents. And that would really take that character to the next level, I think. Like, you know that from the book, like you were just talking about, Cam, but that's another thing that I think could have... I don't think this movie would have been bad with 15 more minutes and 5 of them were doing that.
I never feel like the movies gave Neville justice. Like, he has justice in the books, and it's like he kind of has that moment in the 8th movie, but, like, as far as, like, who, like, in this movie, or this book at least, goes to adding that, like, Neville could have just as easily been the prophecy's Harry. He was the second prophetic one, or whatever you want to call it. And so it's sad to me that, like, he doesn't get that same, like, it's this, like, other side to Harry of, like, what Harry could have. There are these, like, opposites of each other, but could have easily been switched. And I wish they had played more with that. But okay, so going to the prophecy, this is something that's always kind of confused me, is, like, what's the importance of having the prophecy? Like, if you know that, like, here's the prophecy, they always felt like, this is something that always kind of, like, sticks in the back of my head, because they're always like, we have to get the prophecy, like, we have a weapon now. And it's like, hey, doesn't everybody already know what the prophecy is? What does it matter if you actually have it? If you have it and it breaks, does that break the potential of the prophecy? That was always something that, like, was like, it's the time travel thing from Prisoner of Azkaban. It kind of sticks in my head, and then as soon as I pass the movie, it's gone, but it's still kind of, like, as I'm watching the movie there.
Yeah, it's very MacGuffin-y. There's not... I don't know. I don't know if it's that they don't know what it says, and they feel like that if they know what it says, then it will... then it was something will change, but I don't know.
Okay. So then we get to arguably the most impactful moment of this film, which is the death of Sirius Black and the aftermath of that. I mean, it's for such a big character. Do you guys think this death on screen does justice to what Sirius was? Like, is this how you envisioned it happening at least?
Yeah, I think, how do I want to say this? So when I read these books as a kid before the film series kind of came out, you know, you have the picture in your brain of what everything is and how it's happening, and you're pronouncing Hermione as Hermione, and and then like you see the movies, and you know, obviously that visual language in your brain changes and adapts, and like these characters become the characters in your brain when you're reading the books, and these locations now exist in your brain when you're reading them and everything. And I will say that ending battle scene with all of the orbs of the prophecies and the veil that Sirius goes through with in the battle with the Death Eaters, J.K. Rowling, the way she writes that, she's such a great visual writer and explaining things like visually to put them in your brain. And then David Yates did such an incredible job of translating that to the screen that it was like almost exactly the way that I pictured it. And I think that the emotional moment, while it probably wasn't as strong as it was in the book, because you have such a stronger attachment to those characters, you've spent longer with those characters, you know more about those characters. I think that they did it an incredible job. I mean, Gary Oldman is Gary Oldman. He's one of the best actors working today. And I think that this is the film where the younger actors really start to show their chops for performances. Are the performances incredible? No, but they're good. And like, you can feel the pain in Daniel Radcliffe compared to the pain in Goblet of Fire when Cedric Diggory was killed, you know? So,
right. Like the acting in that last little, like, moment where him and Voldemort are kind of having like a battle inside of Harry. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think that's when Daniel Radcliffe, I'm like, ooh. Harry?
Yeah.
Somebody's been practicing.
Yeah. David Yates does clearly a much better job.
Yeah. All right. So moving on to the sixth movie, Half-Blood Prince, it's, you know, our first before that two-part finale. And there's a lot of, you know, this is one of those films that, much like how the third film kind of set things up, I think this is very much like a setup film for the finale. You get the introduction of Horcruxes and the importance of like what that means to the universe, what that means to Voldemort's plan, how that affects Harry and Dumbledore's plan. You get all these different pieces coming into play that result really in the seventh movie. You have these emotional ties, there's so much going on setup wise. So what are your guys' thoughts on this film overall?
I love this movie. I think it's fantastic. The best part of this movie is Tom Felton's performance as Draco Malfoy and what his character is going through. Like, this is the one time that I know I complained about this, but it really humanizes someone on the bad side. And we see kind of who is Draco? Like, who is he actually going to be? Like, he's been like this mean punk kid, but like, this is him deciding like what kind of person he's actually going to be. And I think it's really interesting. And I think Tom Felton plays it really well.
Yeah, there's that line at the top of the tower when he's like, for lack of a better term, like holding Dumbledore hostage right before he's about to kill him, where he's like, I have to do this. Like, and you kind of feel that, like, he's really like fearful for his life, fearful for like family's life. He understands like the weight of like, this is a terrible thing, but if I don't do it, terrible things are going to happen to other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think they do a really good job with Draco Malfoy and Tom Felton's character. This, Okay, I'm very conflicted about Half-Blood Prince because I really like it in terms of like how it's done technically. And I think that it also does a really good job of character development. But I think the reason that I struggle with it is because a lot of that character development is from like exposition of the past. You know, it's a lot of information coming to us through the characters and not a lot of the characters acting on the world besides like the last third of the film. Does that make sense?
Mm.
And so while I think it does a fantastic job of progressing the character of Draco Malfoy, progressing the character of Snape and all of those other incredible characters that we've grown to love, and obviously the Dumbledore moment, I mean, that's a freaking punch in the gut. I think that while this is probably like emotionally the strongest film, I think that plot wise it's not as interesting as Order of the Phoenix or Deathly Hallows, because in those films it's Harry, Ron, and Hermione like acting and reacting to what's happening around them,
but
not Harry being like sad and learning information.
Yeah, what I like about this is that all this information that Harry is learning, it makes him kind of paranoid, and it makes the mm-hmm. viewer kind of question a little bit, like, is this mm-hmm. the guy who's actually the hero? Like, is he gonna get this done? Like, what's yeah. going on? And I think that's what this is definitely more of a slower, more thoughtful movie than we've seen in the series up to this point. But I really like that. This movie really worked for me. It's probably one of my two or three favorites in the series.
No, I definitely like, yeah, I like it a lot, and it's definitely like in the top half of the series for me. I feel like a lot of people are like super high on it, and I'm not as high on it as a lot of people are.
I like that it's this like slow-paced, methodical adventure before we get to like the last two films are pretty like go go go. There's constantly something, I mean, especially the second one, there's constantly something happening. This to me feels like what Prisoner of Azkaban was for the first half of the series. This is for the second half. It's a slower, more character driven piece that has some action at the end, but it's much more about establishing who these characters are going into that film.
And it's
I love that. I think that's
it's very it's also very episodic. There's not really a lot of overarching things. I mean, I know like the Half-Blood Prince, the book and all that kind of stuff, but there's like, well, this independent thing happened and then this thing happened and then this thing happened. I like that I feel like the other movies kind of like backload the school year into the movie. Like you see like half of the movie is the last month of the school year, but this one I feel mm-hmm. like really spreads everything out and gives you that true sense of time passing.
Yeah, that's a great point. Jake, you touched on a little bit, but this film has arguably the most heartbreaking scene moment in the entire series. And it's, well, I guess it's kind of twofold. There's that scene of Harry giving Dumbledore the liquid from the basin
mm-hmm.
in order to get the Horcrux, and you know, Dumbledore no more, and the kind of frenetic pacing and editing of that scene is really well done. And Trevor, you talked about in the last about like the power of Dumbledore. I mean, I think that's on display here in such an amazing way too, of you know, him and the Inferi. And just that, like, the heartbreak of that moment at the end when Snape kills Dumbledore, because at that time, like, you don't understand why Snape has done that. You come to understand later on, but at least for me, it's like, I get so sucked into that moment that it's like, you've so been waiting for Snape to be like, okay, I'm a good guy. Like, I have my dark side, but it's like, I'm overall on this side. Like, I'm just kind of a troubled person. But this is that moment when you're like, not only are you heartbroken that Dumbledore died, but you're heartbroken that like Snape was the one to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Because you've been rooting for him to be that good guy that you know he can be. It's just kind of like this kick in the chest that, like, it's just heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
Do you guys think? So what's interesting to me is that all these films work in explaining certain characters to us more. Like, I feel like certain movies give certain characters more of a, there's always like one character in each book that kind of feels like they kind of get, outside of Harry, the spotlight of like, okay, let's learn a little bit more about this person. And I mean, obviously in the title, The Half-Blood Prince, do you guys think this does a good job of, in retrospect, giving us an eye into the mind of Severus Snape? Well, that's a long-winded question.
Yeah, I do. I think it's great. I think it's interesting. You know, there's only only two other people besides Harry Potter get mentioned in a title in this series. And there's Sirius and Snape. And I think that that's not by accident that it's those two people. I think those are... You know, there's a ongoing conflict between those two people specifically. There's also an ongoing conflict within Harry that relates directly to each of them. And I think that this being about the Half-Blood Prince, and especially Harry learning about him while not knowing who it is that he's learning about, is really interesting and helps build up Harry's relationship to Snape, especially as we see it kind of come to an end moving forward.
Hmm. Hmm. Yes, Snape is one of the most interesting characters I think ever written. At least in books that I've read, you know. And I think that this film is really the one that like wraps up his incredible storyline, and they do it in such a good job, and it's so impactful at the end when he kills Dumbledore, because it's a roller coaster ride of you hating Snape, loving Snape, questioning Snape, really hating Snape, then being like, well, maybe he had to do it. Maybe it's all part, you know? Yeah, it's such an interesting character, and this film does such a good job.
So moving on to Deathly Hallows Part 1 and 2. The first question I want to ask, and just really quickly, I'm always curious to get people's thoughts. Do you guys think, because I feel like 90% of the time when somebody splits what should be a finale into two parts, it's a bad idea. Do you guys think splitting this book into two parts is a bad idea?
No, not at all. Every movie should have been two parts.
Okay. If anything, yeah, they should have all been three parts. Let's get 21 films. Can't do math tonight.
Yeah.
I'm directly going to say no, because... spoilers for later, this is my favorite movie in the series. Part one
or part two?
I love part one.
So talk a little bit about,
I know,
why
part one,
you love,
I believe,
part one,
by like Rotten Tomatoes and Metacritic is the worst reviewed film in the series. The thing about part one is that nothing happens at all and you can't look away. It just, the subtlety, the quietness, it just brings you in completely. I think the scene with Harry and Hermione dancing to the Nick Cave song is one of the best scenes of the entire series. It's absolutely fantastic.
It's almost like the whole series, this, like, these kids have been successful at everything they've done.
Yeah.
And then it's just a movie of them failing.
They have no effing clue what to do, and it's awesome. I love it. It's perfect. It's what the right. characters needed. Like, it's what everyone needed to be. Hermione, who always knows the answer to everything, doesn't know what to do. Harry, who's always ready for action, doesn't have any actions to take. Ron, finally, like, the deepest, worst parts of Ron that we see from time to time finally come out in full force, and then he comes and just completely destroys them. The movie is the three of them, and we finally get a time where no one else is in the way. We get our three main characters, our heroes, and we get to see everything that they're doing. And it's not really anything, because they have no idea what to do. They're 17 years old trying to save the world. The guy who had all the answers is dead. Right. They don't know what to do. But it's just, I just love this movie. I saw it at midnight and I went back and saw it the next afternoon and I still love it. It's the way that it hits you just on an emotional level. It's a very different thing than the rest of the series, I think. And it has its action and it has its cool stuff. They do the, you know, they break into the ministry and get the locket and all that kind of stuff that's really fun and cool. And we get the great showdown at the end. But like I said, I'm always fascinated by
Rice.
Yeah, you get a little. Oh, that's right, a little Rice Efens. You get the beautiful.
Also, maybe one of the best.
Yes,
like,
exactly.
Animated sequences.
The beautiful animation in the Tale of the Three Brothers. I just love this film.
Yeah, I'm with you, Trevor. This is my second favorite film of the series, behind Order of the Phoenix. And everything you said is totally accurate. I think it's just so different because it's an intimate character study and the way that it's shot too. Like it's so visually different because obviously like we're not at Hogwarts and all that stuff. But I mean, even from like the opening sequence of like Hermione having to wipe her parents' memory.
Oh my gosh.
And then them in the cafe when they get attacked by Death Eaters. It's like, it's so much more like in your face. Shaky cam isn't the right word, but it's much more of like a small action drama. We're up in the characters. We're in the scene with them versus the grand sweeping VFX filled things that we'd seen in the previous films. This is like gritty characters fighting for their lives. And like you said, these are kids just like trying to figure out how to save the world. We see them push to their limits individually and as a friend group, and we get some incredible acting performances from these characters. This is my second favorite. It's really close with Prisoner of Azkaban, but I think just the more I think about it, it's so different. And I definitely need to go back and rewatch some of these films. Like the more that we're talking about it, I'm just like, man, it's been a while since I've seen that. I forgot how good that was. But this is one of those films like since the first time I saw it, I was like, wow, this is.
And from the very first, image is that extreme close up on Bill Nighy as Rufus Scrimgeour these are dark times. It's just like, well, this is it. Like, the shit's hitting the fan now. Like what we've been afraid of for 6 books. Like it's finally happening. This is it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right. And I know we joked about it earlier on in the podcast, but Dobby dying is really a heartbreaking scene.
It hurt.
Like that's, and it's weird going back because I've been watching the films again. I'm on Half-Blood Prince and there's a line in the second movie at the end of it when Harry has freed Dobby through Lucius Malfoy and all that kind of stuff, where he looks at Dobby and says, Dobby, just make me a promise that you'll never try and save my life again. And it's like watching that now with the knowledge. And I don't think when that movie came out in 2002, like, there's no way they could have known that like Dobby would die in the 7th book saving Harry Potter. That book didn't come out for another, 6 years. Mm-hmm. And so it's one of those things that's like, it's such a heartbreaking like line, like, 5 movies before it actually even happened.
Yeah. It's, I mean, those girls behind us wept like a family member died in front of them. Oh, I mean, man. That's like how powerful.
But Dobby is a,
That's a testament to what
it's
they've
a,
done.
It's a definitely a you the real MVP situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. Also, why were magical elves not used more in to battle Voldemort if they're that powerful?
Yeah.
Just a little. Actually, I think in the 7th book, I think they do fight in the battle.
Yes, they.
I
yes,
think you're
they,
right.
They. You're right.
If I remember right.
Yes, I think you're right.
All right, so getting on to the last film, it starts off and we instantly kind of just, where things are going. We're going back to Hogwarts and it's only a matter of time before we get there. And then it's a mad dash for several different things, it's to protect Hogwarts, to give Harry enough time to destroy the Horcruxes. There's so many different things going on, and I think one of the beauties of this last film is, for as simple as the seventh film was, this film is, like, on the opposite end, complicated, but everything has its place.
I feel like this film, because this is what I'm doing in my brain, I need it, like, every 5 minutes, I need, on, like, the bottom left of the screen, for the list of the Horcruxes to pop up and, like, cross off the ones that have been destroyed. Like, okay, so where are we? We're going after, right. Okay, we need the cup. That's next. All right. Let's get the cup.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And then it's like, oh, wait, then there's another one. And, like, okay, so, like, just going ahead and getting into it, realizing that Harry is a Horcrux, and that, like, on that night he became, like, a seventh Horcrux is like heartbreaking, because you instantly know what has to happen. It's like this promise of, like, what I so wished that Christopher Nolan would have done with Batman, and, like kill Batman. Like, that's, like, as dark as that sounds, like, that's what makes sense. That's the natural progression for the character. It's like, you get to see that in this film. It's like, and it doesn't feel cheap. It doesn't feel like it wasn't, like, worked for. It's like, I'm going to kill him just for the shock value. It's like, no, that's the natural progression of where this would go. Like, it's like, once you realize what Horcruxes are, it's like, there's no other conclusion other than, like, wow, Harry has
it. Almost
Horcrux.
It makes so much sense that it had to have been one of the first things that Rowling came up with when she's building this basic idea.
She wrote the end of the seventh book on napkins in a coffee shop before she wrote anything.
Yeah, I mean, that's the way it had to be.
And the scene in which they do it, with, like, Harry being, like, he's surrounded by Lupin and Sirius and his parents, and he's like, will you guys be with me as I do this? And they're like, till the end. And it's just like, oh, it breaks your heart.
Yeah, I think, and the great thing about this is that we've, you know, I said in you start doubting Harry a little bit a couple movies before this, especially in Half-Blood Prince. But we've come back around so much that once he realizes what has to happen, there's no doubt in your mind that he's going to do what he needs to do. And I think the way that that's built through these last couple of films is really impressive. My big issue with this film is that, for someone who has not read the books, I don't think it's clear that Harry is dead.
Because, I mean, like, in the book, they
make
it clear.
Right, right. I don't think that that's abundantly clear if you don't know that's happening already. And I mean, I love the scene at the Heaven/King's Cross with Dumbledore. That's fantastic. But there needed to be something.
And Horcrux Voldemort under the bench.
Oh, that was fantastic. But there needed to be something more definitive in my mind. Because it almost looks like it doesn't seem, I don't know, I keep saying definitive, but it didn't really seem definitive from someone, like, thinking about it from a perspective of not knowing what's happening. Especially because the next time you see him is Hagrid's carrying him, and then, oh, he's awake. Look out.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think, like, Deathly Hallows as a book and as, like, the two films together is definitely one of the best of the series as a whole. I think when you split the film in half like that, which is that's what it is. Like, when you make one book two films, you're splitting a movie in half and to make more money. I think Deathly Hallows Part 2 is one of my least favorite standalone films, just because it's a giant battle scene basically. That's really all it is. But I do think that Deathly Hallows as a whole is fantastic. And so, I don't know. I'm in the weird category of Deathly Hallows Part 2 is my least favorite Harry Potter movie, because it's not a full movie.
Yeah, I don't think it's...
That would have been a great hot take.
I don't think it's great either. I also think that the final battle between Harry and Voldemort doesn't carry the weight that it should.
No. I think, like, the whole, like, wand... That's, like... So, I mean, I'll go ahead and say it. This is on the top half of my Harry Potter films list. I love this movie, and part of it is like the culmination of so many different things. Like, you have Neville's story and like him finally getting that opportunity. You have Harry and like all the emotion behind that. And we haven't even talked about like fully realizing how good of a human Snape is, like what he's been doing all this time, which is just like the most brilliant.
Like, he was playing the long
amazing
game.
Scene.
Mm-hmm.
Playing the long game. And then it's like that moment, that line that like I'll tear up talking about it, but like, cause Alan, I mean, it was tweeted nonstop when Alan Rickman passed away, but it's the line of like, he shows his Patronus and it's a doe, and Voldemort or Dumbledore is like, after all this time. And it's the line of just always that stinking word is like, oh, so powerful. I think this movie does a great job 99% of the time, with the exception of the end battle between Harry and Voldemort.
Yeah, it doesn't quite land the plane in that moment. I don't know. It just, I think it's right. Because you'd been like basically going balls to the wall for 2.5 hours, and then it was kind of just like a, okay, it's over. Like his, it wasn't like a build up situation.
I think maybe the wand shouldn't break. It's some kind of a cop out, you know? It's like,
it shouldn't slow motion fly through the air and land in Harry's
hand. Yeah.
That's what it shouldn't do. It should be a like hard fought battle of these like two amazing wizards going back and forth. And then it's like, if you want to end it with Voldemort, like, for lack of a better term, like breaking, great. But it's like the wand doesn't need a slow motion fly through the air. That feels like the end of like a football game when it's like the quarterback like chunks up the football and it's flying through the air in slow motion. Everybody on the sidelines is like, what's gonna happen? And then before you know it, the guy like magically catches it in the end zone, and the bad guy's like, no. And then at the end he's like, great game, buddy. It's like, this isn't,
you can ride, you know, my tail
three. Right, this isn't Top Gun. Like, this is Harry Potter. Like, that's not the way that should have ended.
I think it's too short. I think that sequence is too short.
What do you guys think about like the Deathly Hallows as an idea as a whole to be like introduced so late in the series?
It seems like
it's been there the whole time.
Yeah.
But like the concept of like the Deathly Hallows.
You mean of like these like three?
Yeah, the three things and the three brothers. Powerful. Like, I know that the invisibility cloak has obviously been around the whole time, and Dumbledore's always had the wand and all that stuff. But I don't know. I don't have complaints about it because I think it was handled so well, and that just shows to like how brilliant J.K. Rowling is in writing this world. But I don't know. I don't know if you guys feel the same way.
Yeah, it's a little weird. Although it's sort of explained kind of by only crazies like Xenophilius Lovegood really buying into the whole thing. Because you know, Ron is familiar with the story, being read the story as a kid, but it seems like it's just a legend kind of thing. So it is a little bit weird that we don't hear anything of them until very late.
But I think it's the same with like Horcruxes. Dumbledore knew what Horcruxes were the entire time, but it's almost like he shielded Harry from them because at the time he didn't need to know what they were. Like, he brought him along as he needed to know.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those things that it's, to me, it's like, I don't think it's bad. It's not, if you had known about them the whole time, like from book one, when Harry's searching for what the Sorcerer's Stone is, he accidentally comes across like, oh, the Deathly Hallows. I don't think that adds anything to the series.
Yeah, I think it would have been too much too fast.
Right. Like, I think it comes along when we need it. It's that, like, I don't know. It works for
me. It's the cherry on top.
Alrighty. So that's it for all 8 films. Let's do our rankings. Starting, so Jake, let's start with you. Go from your least favorite to your favorite.
Least favorite. Okay. Least favorite is Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2. I'm not going to say Harry Potter every time because that's unnecessary. So number 8, Deathly Hallows Part 2. Number 7, Chamber of Secrets. Number 6, Sorcerer's Stone. Number 5, Goblet of Fire. Number 4, Half-Blood Prince. Number 3, Prisoner of Azkaban. Number 2, Deathly Hallows Part 1. And number 1, Order of the Phoenix.
All right. Number 8, Goblet of Fire. Number 7, Sorcerer's Stone. Number 6, Chamber of Secrets. Number 5, Deathly Hallows Part 2. Number 4, Order of the Phoenix. Number 3, Half-Blood Prince. Number 2, Deathly Hallows Part 1. And number 1, Prisoner of Azkaban.
Mine is fairly similar to Trevor's. Mine is in last place, Chamber of Secrets. 7 is Sorcerer's Stone. 6 is Goblet of Fire. 5th is Half-Blood Prince. 4th is... Fifth is Order of the Phoenix. 4th is Half-Blood Prince. 3rd is Harry Potter, Deathly Hallows Part 2. Number 2 is Deathly Hallows Part 1. And my favorite is Prisoner of Azkaban. Seems like Deathly Hallows Part 1 is all pretty high on our list.
Which is interesting because I don't think that's a really popular take. I don't think a lot of people like...
I think it's the lowest rated Rotten Tomatoes, isn't it?
It's the second lowest rated, or it's tied for the lowest rated with Order of the Phoenix.
Wow, those are my two favorites.
They're both at 78. The next lowest is Philosopher's Stone or Sorcerer's Stone and Chamber of Secrets.
Sweet. Well, they're wrong. So
quickly, I mean, if you're like giving, where is this in like the all-time great film franchises for you? Is this, you know, Star Wars, Avengers, James Bond, Indiana Jones,
Mission Impossible?
Lord of the Rings, where is
you
this
forgot
on
to
you
say
guys?
Mission Impossible.
Like, Mission Impossible. Yeah. Sorry. The Star is Born franchise.
I think it's in that top echelon.
The
MCU has made this a hard thing to talk about because the volume is insane. It almost like doesn't count because it's a, like you said, Cam, it's a TV show. It's just a giant budget TV show. I think it's not quite Star Wars for me. And that's kind of a personal thing. I don't really have a real reason. It just doesn't have that Star Wars cachet. But everything else that you mentioned, Cam, it's right there.
Yeah.
So for me, I hadn't really thought about this much until we kind of started prepping this episode. And if you're looking at franchises as a whole, in terms of like the quality of films in the entire franchise, and I'm talking about Star Wars, I'm talking about Lord of the Rings, I'm talking about... I'm not counting the MCU because that's a TV show. but like...
Fast and the Furious?
Dom
and the Boys?
Any of those like iconic Hollywood franchises, I think that you could say that this is the best franchise. Even better than Star Wars. Because if you look at the quality of film over 9 films so far, 10 about to come out this weekend, all of them are good. Not a single one of them is rotten. And that no other franchise achieves that. So I think personally for me it's like top 3. But I think you could easily make the argument that this is the best Hollywood franchise of all time.
I think, and to add on to what I was saying, with the exception, Lord of the Rings is kind of a different animal too, because those were shot basically like one movie.
And it's hard with that because like the two trilogies are completely different in how good
they
are.
Yeah. So The Hobbit messes up Lord of the Rings for me.
So I think...
Right. If The Hobbit's up to the standard of Lord of the Rings, it's a completely different ballgame.
Yeah. I think this... What sets this series apart is the cohesion of it. Like, it's the same thing. It's not... Like, we have different directors, but it's the same feel, it's the same message, it's the same cast. And that's not the case in a lot of these other things.
It's definitely up there for me. I don't... it's hard to put the MCU in that category, and I've talked about my love of Lord of the Rings and Star Wars, but Jake, I think you're right. If you put all the films and all the franchises together, I think if you're giving an average rating, this is number one.
Yeah, I mean, it's just the quality level amongst almost 10 movies is unprecedented and unrivaled, really, besides the MCU, but I don't know. That just, like we said, I feel like that doesn't count. It doesn't feel...
It's a different... TV, they're playing a different series. Game.
Yeah, they are.
They just got done with season one.
Exactly.
Or they're about to get done with season one.
Insane.
Okay, let's... I have to interrupt and talk... We have to talk about one thing that we didn't talk about, and that's how they hit the casting jackpot with Matthew Lewis. They cast this chubby, freckled kid as a 10-year-old who was perfect for the role at the time, and he like literally physically grows into the character he's supposed to become. Like he's tall, yeah. He's handsome, he plays the character well, he delivers an incredibly rousing line that he completely deserves at the end. It just that I can't, like, how lucky can you get with casting? That's insane. Just crazy.
I'm going to give my final thoughts too before we move on to content of the week, something that we didn't really cover. We've talked about the performances, we've talked about the visuals, we've talked about the stories themselves, all of that stuff, but two things that I really want to hit on that make these movies as magical as they are is the score by John Williams.
Oh, yeah.
Possibly the best score he has ever done, honestly. It is so musically complex and magical that it truly transports you to this world. Without this score, these movies do not feel the way that they would feel. And also the production design. This is some of the best world building ever in cinema, ever. And neither the production designer nor John Williams ever won an Oscar for Harry Potter. And that is a crime.
Yeah, everything...
Harry Potter won.
Everything
zero
looks perfect in every movie. The sets are perfect every time.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yep. I'll give my final thought. I don't need a jump forward 20 years to know what Harry and everyone are doing, dropping their kids off at Hogwarts. That kind of ruined the magic for me. I don't want to see Beer Belly Ron standing there. So as my final shot of the movie, I would have been
bad old man of makeup.
I don't love it either. I think they do that. That's for Draco. That's your Draco closure. That's why it's there.
Yeah.
But I hate I hate that that's there strictly because of that. Like, that's right. Like, yeah, you get that kind of Draco bit. I just hate it. I hate it. All right, content of the week. Jake, what is your content of the week?
Yeah, so this month has been a lot slower for me. So I'm like getting back into video games, and I just played the new Spider-Man game for PS4, and it's honestly the best Spider-Man movie ever. Like, it's the only good thing that Sony has ever done with the character of Spider-Man. If you have a PlayStation 4, highly recommend it. You feel like Spider-Man and Peter Parker. It's awesome. And then also, I've talked about it before on this show, the Soundtrack Show is a podcast. They actually just are in the middle of a multiple part series on the soundtrack of Harry Potter. So if you find this interesting, go check that out. And they go like super deep on the music behind the Harry Potter series. Yeah.
Trevor. Okay, I got some music stuff. First is the song that I talked about that's in Deathly Hallows Part 1 that Harry and Hermione dance to is by Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds. It's on the album 2004 The Abattoir Blues / Lyre of Orpheus. The song is called O Children, and it's just a beautiful, haunting song. So definitely check that out. Give it a listen. The whole album is really good. I also want to recommend another album. It's from last year, but I just kind of came across it. It's called Emperor of Sand from the metal band Mastodon. And so Mastodon is kind of, they call it prog metal or progressive metal. It's a really It's like a more accessible form of Metallica, to kind of succinctly state it. So if you like a little bit of hard rock, aren't really ready to get into the metal kind of thing, the lyrics are audible. You can understand what they're saying. There's not the throaty growl. But I really enjoyed kind of the soaring melodies, giant guitars of that newest album from Mastodon.
We didn't touch on everything in Harry Potter. Obviously, it would have been an 8-hour podcast like we had joked about. If you are wanting something more in-depth and podcast form, The Ringer has been doing a great series. Too in-depth, maybe some might say, through their Binge Mode podcast, where they have literally broken down everything, like over multiple months. It's there are some times where it's like, okay. But overall, it's just kind of like a fun thing. Like, I've been listening to the books again as they've been putting out the episodes. So it's been kind of fun to just like relive it all. Other than that, you know, we haven't done a podcast in a while where all of us have been on it. And so, you know, I feel like it's time to say, like, guys, Survivor's back.
Man. Listen, I forget that show exists until you bring it up.
Yeah. Like, I think you're the only person that still watches it.
We're on season 37, and I know season 36, Ghost Island, wasn't great. But guys, season 37, David versus Goliath, has been incredible.
Wait, are there only two
Mike
people?
Mike White, Mr. Schnegle.
Wait, what's the format here? Who is David?
It's a group of Davids who are people who haven't had everything handed to them in life, had to work and come up and do things on their own, versus Goliaths, who are people who have like kind of had things handed to them, had life a little bit easier. They're successful, but they've kind of been given
that
success.
Which one is Ned Schneeble?
He's on the success. His dad, like Mike White, was a famous writer.
Interesting.
So Mike White is on the show, though.
Weird.
So take from that what you will. It's a great cast this season. There's a lot of interesting storylines. If you're a new person that's looking to jump into Survivor for a first time, I'd say do it now.
37 seasons in. Just hop right in.
546 episodes. Okay.
It's like, that's more episodes than watching Cheers twice.
That's ridiculous. I don't even know.
Respect for Jeff Probst. Best job in the world.
Yeah.
He just says respect. One of eight phrases over and over again while wearing a Hawaiian shirt in exotic locations.
I can't wait to explain to my kids someday. So it's exciting. So that's all we have for this week's episode. We'll be back next week with a new episode and a review of Overlord, the new film from Bad Robot that is pretty much, from the looks of it, Nazi zombies.
So
from
the way I view Overlord, it looks like, so you know how Inglourious Basterds was an alternate history of World War II? I think that Overlord is the alternate history of Inglourious Basterds.
Okay.
It's the alternate history.
That's good. I like that.
It's like the second alternate. It's the Ken Jeong playing Jeff, who's playing the dude.
There you go.
All right. If you've enjoyed listening to us, go to iTunes, subscribe, rate, review us, go share us with your friends and family. If you want to know more about us, you can go to our website at popcornoptional.com, where you can also find all of our episodes on there as well. If you want to interact with us, the best place to do that is on Twitter at popcornoptional. My name is Cameron Salina. You can find me online at 321 Cami Time. Jake, where can we find you online?
You can find me at jakebrown.tv. That's my website and my Instagram.
I'm on Twitter and Instagram at TurboTrevor.
Until next time, we hope you have a great week. Watch some movies, and in the words of Michael Scott, we'll be back ASAP as possible.
Bye.
You'll be good.
Harry Potter, singing a song. all day long at Hogwarts.